Welcome to another episode of the Bukhari Sellers Podcast. Thank you so very much for everybody tuning in today. We have a very, very special episode today. We have Faleke Olawofoyeku is joining us today on the Bukhari Sellers Podcast from Bob Hart's Abishola. It is a dope show, a great show. I'm so happy to see just the culture and the diaspora flourishing for the world to see. Nigerian culture is flourishing for the entire world to see on Bob Hart's Abishola. It is such a brilliant, well-put-together piece, and we're going to talk to Faleke about that today and her activism and SARS. We'll get into some of the politics of the day. But before we get to that, I just wanted to take a minute and talk about the decision ruled recently by District Attorney in Piscataquis County, Andrew Womble, in the case of Andrew Brown Jr. This week, District Attorney Womble came out and said that the shooting of Andrew Brown Jr. was a justified shooting and that the officers in this case would not face any state criminal charges. Later in the day, the sheriff stated that the officers would not lose their job. However, they would be disciplined, quote unquote, disciplined and retrained. Needless to say, as an attorney who represents the Brown family, not just Gerard and Khalil, but also his five younger children, this was a very disappointing outcome, but not one that was unexpected. Many may not know that just last week, we sent a letter to the district attorney pursuant to North Carolina state law asking the district attorney to recuse himself. And the reason we took that step is because after finding out who the officers were, who fired shots, we were able to come to the conclusion that these officers for the better part of a decade have been working with District Attorney Womble and his office in prosecuting hundreds, if not thousands, of cases in the county. And just to add more clarity to the conflict, his office is literally in the building that the sheriff's department is housed. And so we thought that the conflict was well-defined, that this incestuous relationship between the district attorney and the sheriff's department was one that would prevent any type of impartiality and would be enveloped in bias. And so we sought that recusal, and many of you all saw this week why we fought so hard for that recusal. After watching that press conference, though, I think I need to say a few things. The first is that we still remain steadfast in the belief that Andrew Brown Jr. at no point used his car as a deadly weapon or posed any type of threat to law enforcement. We believe that his killing was not justified. And even if you see or believe that at any point throughout this episode, his car was used as a weapon or he posed a threat, the threat was no more when he was beyond officers and they continued to fire, including firing the kill shot into the back of his head. There are a few things for the show at the top of the show I want to point out. The first is that the district attorney made allusions that the vehicle made contact with law enforcement. Well, in fact, law enforcement initiated contact on not one but two occasions. The first was when law enforcement jumped out of the car. Andrew Brown Jr. dropped his phone and law enforcement grabbed the handle of his car and he began to back up. When he backed up, law enforcement let go of the handle and pushed against the car. That is the first contact that the district attorney points to. The second is when he backed all the way up. Of course, no officers were behind him and he began to go forward. He did not go straight ahead or just veer slightly to the left to use his car to hit officers. Instead, he veered strongly to the left where an officer then reached out and pushed the car away from him. At that point, he was beyond the officers. The officers fired shots. And as we know in Tennessee v. Gardner and many other cases, you cannot shoot individuals in the back as they're fleeing, particularly those that no longer pose a threat. And a few things that District Attorney Womble never got to, explaining how this man was shot in the back of the head, explaining why there were bullets that were found in homes across the street, explaining why officers fired through an extended school zone at 8:20 in the morning, explaining why officers fired in the direction of other officers, explaining why they violated their own policy, which is clear, Their recklessness was beyond clear in this matter. Their actions were not justified. And for anyone who wants to ask the question, will Andrew Brown, or make the statement, will Andrew Brown, he fled, he ran. Resisting arrest and fleeing is not a death penalty crime in this country. And Andrew Brown deserved the dignity of having due process. And because he did not get that dignity, there are 7 children who today have no father. Andrew Brown was murdered and will continue the process of seeking justice. I want you all also to know that justice means changing laws on the state and local level, not just the George Floyd Justice and Policing Act. Because of the laws in North Carolina, we have not been able to get the body cameras released in totality. We have not been able to get the district attorney recused. These officers are back at work. This is going to happen again because of the laws of the state of North Carolina. We have to fight like hell to get good people elected from the district attorney office to the state legislature, and also be sure that we change the laws which codify obstruction of justice. And that's that on that. Now on to our show with Foleke, the star of Bob Hart's Abishola.
This episode is brought to you by Anytime Fitness. We're not all professional athletes, but we all have health goals. That's why Anytime Fitness gives you access to personalized plans and support from a coach. Plus, you can track your training, nutrition, and recovery progress with the Anytime Fitness app, just like the pros. With 24/7 access to more than 5,000 gyms worldwide, get more from your gym membership. Visit anytimefitness.com to try it for free today. Terms, conditions, restrictions all apply. See website for details. This episode is brought to you by Lincoln and the all-new 2024 Nautilus Hybrid, featuring a customizable 48-inch panoramic display, available Revel audio system, and available perfect position front seats with active motion massage. Oh my God, the world isn't wide enough. Visit Lincoln.com to learn more. Some models, trims, and features may not be available or may be subject to change. Check with your local retailer for current information. Lincoln and Nautilus are trademarks of Ford or its affiliates.
Thank you for joining the Bakari Sellers podcast. How are you doing today?
I'm good. Thanks for having me.
I see you. Are you sipping on your coconut water over there? Is that what that is?
No.
Oh, you? Oh, just water.
Okay. I'm drinking just water, not coconut just, water.
You got to stay, keep your skin flourishing and everything. You know, I usually start off all my episodes the same way. I like to walk our guests through the arc of your career. And it's my understanding that you started off Broadway, moving to television and film, and now back to television as a sitcom star. When did you decide that you wanted to act? And talk us through why you decided to take this role in this now hit show.
Those are a lot of questions, and there are a lot of ways for me to answer it.
I'm doing my best Don Lemon impersonation here. I just tried to wrap it all in one.
I mean, I can't really talk about my career without talking about the extent to which I had to manipulate and disguise my intentions so that my family allowed me to pursue the arts, because that's where it started. I had to literally leave Nigeria and leave my family, leave my continent, and move to another continent to have the freedom to then, for the first time in my life, explore my creative aspirations and my talents. So I initially wanted to do music. I guess you could say I'm one of those, perhaps in quote, lucky people who knew exactly what they wanted to do from a young age. It wasn't nurtured, and I virtually had no outlet, creative outlets in Nigeria, because of the way the economy is set up, because of traditions. So it wasn't until I moved to New York that I then was free. And I got into everything. I got into modeling, I got into music, I got into acting. And the reason I ended up in acting was because my parents were specifically opposed to music. And so I figured that maybe through acting, I could segue into music. The end goal was always music. And acting came, it was natural for me. And a lot of doors opened as soon as I went in there. So I guess in a way, perhaps it was serendipity. I don't know. I just ended there. Ended up in the
fortuitous. It was fortuitous even. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And everything I knew about, I learned about acting, majority of the things I learned about acting, I learned at the City College of New York. And the theater department there was amazing. They were very nurturing. First time I had that sort of environment that was encouraging and validated the things that I wanted to do creatively. And then from there, I started thinking about, well, what's the next step after this? And I wanted to gain as much experience as possible because I didn't have time to waste. I had something to prove to my family. Like, look, I got to stay here. Like, I got to either stay here or I got to stay in the arts, because they were all expecting me to graduate with a law degree. They thought I was studying economics and then going on to law school. So I needed to give them something concrete. Like, hey, this is what I'm doing. You're not just wasting your money. So I started doing a ton of extra work, started auditioning for off-board, pretty much anything I could get my hands on outside of school, as well as inside of school. So I was working part-time at the information desk at City College in New York. And then I was doing plays in school, two or three plays at the time. And then I was also on the basketball team, and I was going to school full-time. So that was pretty much my introduction into the world of theater, into the world of acting. I learned a lot. It taught me a lot of discipline. I was also modeling there on the side. And pretty much anything I could get my hands on to give my parents concrete information and concrete proof that I was out here doing something meaningful.
And you keep mentioning your parents, but your father was a prominent attorney in Nigeria and active in Nigerian politics. And your family wanted you to become a lawyer and go into the family business of law and politics. Are you still active in Nigerian politics? And for our listeners who may not follow as closely, can you talk about what it was like growing up in a family as prominent as yours was in Nigerian politics?
Well, I think there was an unspoken expectation that I had, like all the members of the family had something to live up to in terms of, how do I put this without putting too much pressure on us. It was unspoken. It was an unspoken rule that you were going to aspire to the heights that your father did, right? And at least for my family, I was named after the first female senior advocate of Nigeria. And that in itself was kind of like a directive, if you will, from my father about what I was going to go on to do with my life. And so, I mean, it's had some perks and it had some pressures, because perhaps it still does even now. And in terms of how involved I am with Nigerian politics, I always have my eye on the ground for what's going on at home. I'm home most of the time when I'm not working, and the state of things right now is not the best economically, politically, socially, pretty much in every way you can think of. There are just so many injustices that just seem to keep on escalating in the country. And I'm not quite sure at what point the politicians are going to say, hey, I've made enough money. Let me look out for my fellow man. And then I wonder how much influences from without, from abroad, are benefiting from the destruction and discord that exists in the country.
You know, I've interviewed probably 75 people for the show, and you've been one of the more interesting interviews I've ever had to prepare for. Just the complexity and the nuance, not just of your character on the show, but who you are. So before we get to Bob Loves Abishola, I want to ask one more question and just talk about the End SARS movement in Nigeria and what it is, and about your activism around that police violence, because I was taken aback by just how much strength and courage you show. And not only how talented you are, but how you utilize your platform to go out and do good throughout the diaspora.
And SARS, unfortunately, has been an ongoing movement in Nigeria for quite a while. And SARS is a particular department of the police force in Nigeria. And they were created as a sort of, well, I guess the same way any police establishment is established, is to combat corruption and injustices. And unfortunately, they ended up being a lot of them ended up being the ones perpetrating these crimes on civilians, responsible for rape, murder, theft. Unfortunately, in the country, you know, bribery and corruption is just like, it's just like an everyday occurrence from every, on every level. Nigerians and Nigerian youths have been calling for the disbandment of SARS because they seem to be escalating with impunity, the crimes they were committing. And, at various points in time, Nigerian officials have said, yes, okay, they've been disbanded. They no longer exist, only for them to come back. And, I think the most violent, at least that we caught, the most violence that we caught on camera regarding this protest happened October 10th, 2020. And, October 20th, 2020. And, there were peaceful protesters at the toll gate in Lekki who were protesting the injustices in general and end SARS, because it became a bigger movement, which was also supported by the Black Lives Matter movement that was also occurring in Nigeria, in America. And they were all peacefully protesting, this afternoon in Lekki when, armed militia, in quote, armed policemen, in quote, because we still haven't gotten exactly any, no one has been held responsible for this. We haven't gotten any clear information about who came and shot at these peaceful protesters. And there were cameras at the toll gates that were taken out right before these people arrived with their guns and cornered the protesters and started shooting them and took their bodies away. The only way we were able to to get information about what was going on was because a few people started recording it on their Instagram live. Officials after the fact came out and said, hey, it wasn't the army, it wasn't the police, they have nothing to do with this. And then later on, they started saying that it never happened. It was video effects. And that's pretty much, as far as I know, where things have ended. Life has gone, it seems to be going on as normal. And still, the government and the officials have not come forward with anybody responsible for that, which is atrocious.
Yeah, I mean, it's injustices throughout the world.
This episode is brought to you by Anytime Fitness. We're not all professional athletes, but we all have health goals. That's why Anytime Fitness gives you access to personalized plans and support from a coach. Plus, you can track your training, nutrition, and recovery progress with the Anytime Fitness app, just like the pros. With 24/7 access to more than 5,000 gyms worldwide, get more from your gym membership. Visit anytimefitness.com to try it for free today. Terms, conditions, restrictions all apply. See website for details. This episode is brought to you by UGG. Y'all know UGG is a brand that athletes wear all the time in the tunnel and on travel days. Well, I bet you think UGG season is only during the colder months of the year. Au contraire, you're wrong. You need to check out the latest spring drop from UGG. They have everything from sandals to clogs. I like the sandals. UGG has you covered for your next spring adventure. Shop the Golden Collection at UGG.com. This episode is brought to you by Major League Baseball. A lot is going on in the world of sports right now, but don't forget the 2024 baseball season. It's officially here. Some pretty exciting things to look forward to. Can the star-studded Dodgers, can they make the World Series? Can Mookie Betts break my heart again? How about the young Orioles? How about the defending champs, the Rangers, trying to become the first back-to-back champs in over two decades? See how far they'll go. Get in on the action by visiting your local ballpark or any ballpark, or you can just go to MLB.com, tap the banner to learn more. Baseball is something else.
Let's talk about the reason that you're here, which is Bob loves Abishola, which is hilarious.
Hearts Abishola.
Yes, Hearts. I love it. First, for the people who haven't heard of the show, what is it about and how can they watch it?
Well, the show is a comedy.
My wife loves it, by the way. My wife just swears by it. So
Thank you. Thank her. So it's a show about, season one starts with a Nigerian nurse who I play, Abishola, who's at work. And while she's doing her rounds, taking care of her patients, this one particular guy named Bob starts cracking jokes and shit Can I say that? I'm sorry.
Please, you can say shit, fuck, whatever you want to.
Okay. starts cracking jokes, and she's trying to work, and he's pretty insistent on getting her to give him some attention and going out on a date. And with the intervention of her Nigerian family, who she lives with in Nigeria, her son, her aunt, and her uncle, and his family, they kind of push them closer together until both of their worlds entwine and they start to get to know each other. And then magic happens. And season two, they're now dating seriously and are engaged. And we kind of take a journey with them on wedding planning for a Nigerian American wedding.
I just want you to know that this is, and you know what's crazy? I don't know why my wife walks around the house calling it Bob Loves Abishola. Bob Hearts Abishola. And it's just, it's, so you break a lot of ground in the show because if I'm not mistaken, this is the first show where Black immigrant family is the center of the show. How do you feel about playing such a pioneering role in how Americans view Black families and particularly Black Nigerian families?
It feels like an honor. It feels like a nice responsibility to have. I wish my parents could see this. it feels, you know, it feels good. I know when I first moved to America, one of the challenges I had was trying to change my accent because I wasn't getting a lot of work because of my Nigerian accent. So I don't think that's necessary. I think there's a time to have like a standard accent, but there's also room to show variety as we exist in the world, especially in America. So I think the show highlights and normalizes us immigrants, Nigerians. And it's a beautiful thing because for a lot of people, this is their first introduction to a Nigerian family. They've heard about the Nigerian princes. They've heard about the email scams, you know, but they've never really gotten to know a Nigerian family and see the similarities that we all share. So it's a beautiful thing. And I think one of the important things for me was to make sure that she was not a caricature, that she was the way I portrayed her was genuine and authentic. And so it was very easy to humanize.
That was going to be my question to you. That was, how did you ensure, because taking on this role is a pioneering role. It's a dope role. I know it's an honor for you. But then you have to ensure that it's authentic because you don't want other Nigerians looking at you like, no, this kind of sideways right here. Like, what's she out there doing? That's not us. So how did you ensure that authentic take?
I mean, the producers and the writers, I think it starts with them. And I think we have like the best team in the business. And for me, when I got the script, I remember spending a lot of time. I remember reading the script and learning the lines, and it was so easy. Like it just flowed like water. The writers are so good because I feel like a good example that a project for me, I'm speaking for myself, is well written is the ease with which the language just flows off your tongue. And that was my experience with the pilot. And I got it and I sat down and I just thought about images I'd seen of Africans in the media I thought to myself, well, what do I want to portray? Like, how do I want this character to be received? If this goes longer than a pilot, what do I want her to stand for? And I considered all the things that she was experiencing. She was a love interest. First, like, can you believe a Nigerian love interest on sitcom? She was a love interest, but she was also stern, disciplined, very focused. So how do I merge those two worlds? And then I had to think about, well, what do I want her to sound like? What part of Nigeria do I want her from? I honed down on Elisha, which is where I'm from. And that's the accent I tapped into. So she's Yoruba. And then you can, depending on where you're from, you can tell exactly what kind of, what region she's from. So these were all the things that I was picking apart and trying to infuse into the character. And one of the things that have caught on is the way Abishala pronounces Bobu. And that was something that was infused into the script. And I was like, well, how do I justify why he laughs at the way she pronounces his name? And I went to a very, very, very strong Nigerian accent to pull that out. And so these are all the things I'm thinking about as I'm trying to create this character. And then obviously the demographic and the fact that the show is in America means that those things still have to be tweaked a little bit to fit the format of the show. But that was my thought process as I was preparing for the character. I wanted her to be genuine. I wanted her experiences to be relatable. And I also wanted to find a balance between her being so tough and strong and still being able to be seen as lovable and a romantic character.
And hilarious. When you you say you spend a lot of time back home, this may be a silly question, but what do people say about the show or say about you now reaching this pinnacle of success that you've reached? I mean, you didn't necessarily do what the expectation was for you, and you come home with this other product that you've exceeded all expectations. I mean, you're at the top of the game now. What's the reception like for you back home?
Oh, it's great. I mean, the preview for the pilot, right after we got picked up, went viral in Nigeria. That was the first step. So all my high school friends from Nigeria were calling me and like hitting me up like, yo, like it's everywhere. And like WhatsApp group, that's what we all use to communicate. So my aunties and my brothers, they're like sending me messages when someone comments, they're sending me the whole screenshot. And it's like, oh, is that your sister? Like, wow, that's little Falake. All that stuff. So that was nice. And then the show started airing in Nigeria last year. And then that's brought some new fans as well. And I remember after we'd finished shooting, right as soon as I was done shooting season one, the next day I was on a plane back home. And I remember I was at Lagos Polo Club. And these two girls like were in the bathroom with me and started reciting lines from the show. And it was like, whoa, that's pretty cool. Yeah. And then I bumped into one of my friends at one of these cafes. And as I walked away, she's like, my auntie says you resemble Abishola. And I was like, that's you. And then they came running out. It was pretty awesome. It was a nice reception.
Congratulations on being renewed for a third season, though. Let me ask you, why do you think Bob Hart's Abishola, why do you think it's become such a popular sitcom? And when you first read the scripts for this role, did you ever imagine that it would have the success that it's had?
No, I mean, there's no way. I mean, as an actor, you always hope, you're always looking for an opportunity to work. But I say that a majority of my time before the show was spent auditioning. And I used to joke around like, what do you do for a living? I audition for a living. And then every once in a while I get to go on set and act. So, I mean, you don't want to set yourself up for failure by thinking way ahead. That's the way I've kind of approached auditions moving forward at a certain point in my career. Just so as a defense mechanism, so I wasn't constantly feeling let down or feeling rejection. So I go and audition and leave it in the room and think about, well, what's next for better or for worse. Those habits have kind of stayed. So I wasn't thinking, everything was a surprise. I did the audition. The first callback was a surprise. The test was a surprise. The pilot pickup was a surprise. The season two was like, that's kind of, I try to stay in the moment. And that's the way I kind of dealt with it. And season three pickup was a surprise, but I'm intentionally making it that way. So it's harder to do, it's easier to deal with.
That's a great way to live life. My last question for you is this, before I let you go, let's talk about your music career, because this isn't just a hobby for you. Because you play the guitar, piano, and worked as a sound engineer, and you're formerly trained in audio engineering. Who have been some of your musical influences? And I mean, are we waiting on you to be a guest on Burna Boy's next album? I mean, tell me what's next for you.
Big up to Burna Boy. Music is a hobby.
He's my favorite artist in the entire world right now.
Yeah, right? Yeah, I'm really proud of him. Congratulations to him. music is kind of a hobby right now. I'm constantly working on music. I have a catalog of songs that I just sit on. But maybe I'll do something with it one day. Let's see. I did study audio engineering because it was very important to me to kind of have control over the sound that I was creating. My sound is, it's a fusion. No one else does what I do musically. And it was hard to kind of explain that to people and to get the right verbiage, to get the right terminology. I felt like I had to study the music myself. So I studied audio engineering. I also taught myself to play the guitar because electric guitar, because that's a sound that's very unique and to my overall sound, but most importantly is something that speaks to me on a different level, on a spiritual level. The same thing with African drums. And I think I'm spending a lot of time just working internally on music before I share it with the world, because it's very important for me that it sounds like me and where I'm going. It's going to be quite interesting.
Listen, I am waiting for that foray and when you drop that album, because if it's been anything like the rest of your career, it's going to be a success and it's going to keep climbing. And I just want to say this was one of the most awesome opportunities I've had in doing this podcast. And thank you for spending some time with me today.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
Before I let you go, I wanted to give a shout out to my friend and former guest of this show. Yes, we are stroking our ego a little bit. Shout out to Philadelphia District Attorney Larry Krasner and the new mayor-elect of the city of Pittsburgh, Ed Gainey. In case you missed it, a police union-driven campaign to oust the reform-oriented district attorney of Philadelphia failed miserably, where Krasner won by 30 points. That's a resounding victory for progressive criminal justice reform and the progressive movement generally. I know I'm hard on progressive friends from time to time, but in Larry's race, I think we saw that you can run in a city where Black voters are dominant and run and win on a platform that's committed to reform. Across the state in Pittsburgh, a Black liberal state representative in Ed Gainey beat two-time incumbent mayor of Pittsburgh, Bill Peduto. How'd he do it? He ran a campaign focused on equity and getting to the root of over-policing in Pittsburgh's Black communities. And he did that in a city that's only about 25% Black. He also did it on a ballot that banned no-knock warrants and solitary confinement. So what should we take from this? I think the takeaway here for my friends that are mayors is that you can run and win on police transparency and reform. It's also a lesson here that we need more progressive DAs everywhere, and you can run and win in the right jurisdiction as a progressive reform-oriented district attorney. It's also a lesson that police unions aren't as powerful as they once were, because very rarely do you see DAs depart this sharply from the law enforcement community and win. I think there's also a lesson here for the Democrats seeking to flip Pennsylvania's Senate seat in 2022. First, progressive ballot initiatives help drive turnout. It's an old Republican trick, but it's one that Democrats need to use more often. Policing, marijuana, and those type of things make the proposition for voting really clear for young and often infrequent voters, and they benefit us up the ballot. Second, you don't have to cater solely to the middle of Pennsylvania or Kentucky in order to win any longer. There's some real wiggle room in running on justice issues and framing them as working class issues that can spike turnout in Philadelphia and Pittsburgh while not losing as badly in central Pennsylvania, because young people and Black and brown people and some liberal and progressive folk live there too. You just have to speak to them. In short, we don't have to be a Republican light in Pennsylvania to win in 22. So congratulations, shout out to D.A. Krasner. You only won because you came on the show. And Pittsburgh Mayor-elect Ed Gainey. And I hope my friends in the Senate Democratic primary in Pennsylvania are taking notice. And that's that on that. We'll see you on Monday with another show. Thanks for tuning in, subscribing, sharing, and suggesting new guests. Have a great day.